Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and am now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I am privileged to host Nicolas Badré for a conversation on innovation in higher education. We'll start off by discussing Nicolas' journey from leadership roles in large industrial companies to education. Then we'll dive deep into innovation in higher education and explore the growth of private higher education institutions, including understanding why students in countries with free public universities still opt to pay for private colleges and universities. Nicolas is founder and director of Copernia, a higher education institution that evolved out of a partnership between Macromedia University in Germany, M. Lyon Business School in France, European University Cyprus, and Noroff in Norway. Prior to founding Copernia, Nicolas was Chief Operating Officer, or COO, of Galileo Global Education, one of the world's leading higher education groups headquartered in France and serving more than 300,000 students across 20 countries. Prior to Galileo, Nicolas spent more than 25 years in industrial leadership, including as Chief Financial Officer of Nexans, the world's second largest cable manufacturer. Nicolas, it's great to have you on. Welcome to the pod.
Good morning, Mande, and thanks for welcoming me. I'm very honored and excited to have this conversation.
Wonderful. So as we start off, before we get to higher education, I'd love to first learn about you and your journey. So please tell us a bit about your family, where you grew up, and ultimately what attracted you to education.
Well, I was born in Grenoble. Grenoble is in the French Alps, southeastern part of France. But actually, we moved quite quickly to Paris when I was six, and I lived around Paris between my sixth and 21st year of existence when I graduated from HEC, a leading business school in France. Then I started to move a lot for some time, and I had a mix of various professional experiences in Austria, Spain, Poland, Germany, Belgium. It took me some time to settle down. I'm back and stable in Paris for some 10, 15 years now. I'm the second of four kids. I have two brothers, one sister. My mother actually used to be a teacher. She was a teacher for so-called classical letters. It means French, Latin, and ancient Greek. And my father has had a very different, very varied career in many different kind of positions and jobs. Interestingly enough, at some point, he used to be the director of a school, the National School for Forestry and Waters in France, a higher education institution, so that I may have in my DNA some traces of education at some point. In any case, I think in the family we had a very strong appetite for learning. That's been a truth all over my my young period. Looking at my family today, my wife is a comedian. She actually converted into acting some 10 years, 15 years ago. And it's interesting because she's now very involved in health education. For 5 years now, she started a program to train students in medicine for patient care. And for that, she uses theater. So she actually writes scenarios with doctors on what they really work on during their days and what they find difficult in their daily life as doctors. Then she develops these scenarios, brings in some theater students from Cours Florent, a drama school in France. And with these students, they play the patients and the young students in medicine play the doctors. And then they analyze how they reacted to the situation. So it's an interesting learning experience. And from a pilot stage some 5 years ago, it became something mandatory in the course of medical studies in France. So it's an interesting thing. The second thing, we have three kids, three daughters, 17, 15, 13 years old, so three teenagers. And one of them, the second one, has a genetic disease, quite rare indeed, which translates into some difficulties for learning. A very important moment is when she was three. It was the first, very first day at school. And when we picked her up at night, the teacher told us, well, you know, probably we won't be able to keep her at school. Very first day. Sure. The beauty is that today, precisely today, she's having exams for the general secondary education certificate. So very fundamental moment and a very foundational journey. And I would say probably this specific journey of hers and of us, in a way, has been very important in my desire to shift my career from industry and finance to education and to make sure that I could contribute to this idea of how can we make education more adapted to the needs of every single individual. Of course, maybe more for people with some disabilities, but fundamentally, what we've learned is that we can adapt many things to help her grow. And by the way, these sort of recipes might apply to all of us. How do we define something which is more personalized, which includes both the neurocognitive aspects, the educational aspects, the adaptive technologies, whatever you name it. And I think this journey, in a way, has been extremely important and has helped me shift to this sort of new career. Because as you mentioned, I spent 25 years in industry, large groups, finance positions. I've spent 4 years as a CEO, first for France, for Galileo, and then for the group. And for 1 year and a half, I'm really dedicated most of my time to creating this approach to really work on what we can do differently in education. So in a more entrepreneurial kind of spirit, even if it's still nested within Galileo.
That's fantastic, Nicola. And thank you so much for sharing all of that about your family and in particular about your daughter and the critical role that she has played in shaping the decision you've made to leave your industrial roles and enter the education field over the last 6 years or so since moving to Galileo in 2019. So I will come back and go touch on more on Copernia and we'll spend a lot more time on that. So I'm going to come right back to the beginning here of growing up in the French Alps and then in Paris in a family of four. So you've mentioned what your parents do. I'd love to learn a bit more about your siblings, your two brothers and sister. So what were some of the main extracurriculars in the house and are they all still in France, etc.?
It's interesting because it really exemplifies how diverse a family can be. My elder brother actually is a very... Well, all of them are extremely interesting and I love them a lot. My elder brother actually used to have a very impressive career in finance. He has been actually CFO of Société Générale, Crédit Agricole in France, two of the largest banks. He has then been actually MD at the World Bank in charge for finance for a few years. And after this couple of, well, I don't know, 3 or maybe 4 years at the World Bank as MD for finance, he decided to create his own impact fund. Called
okay,
Blue
so
Like
that's
an
the
Orange.
Black sheep. Now we can get to the rest.
so he actually created a fund called Blue Like an Orange Sustainable Capital, and which is aimed at defining very specific tailor-made answers to the financing needs of impactful projects in the emerging worlds, notably in Latin America. So very specific profile. My second brother, my younger brother, is actually a prosecutor. So he's been in justice for 20 plus years, very involved in different positions. Notably, at some point, he was very closely connected to the anti-terrorist attacks in France. And more recently, he has been prosecutor in the French Alps, precisely, for some years. And my younger sister, actually, she's extremely talented for writing. And she created some theater plays when she was, a teenager, when she was 18, 20. She created and played into her own plays. Then she worked for 15 years writing stuff for the French Senate. And finally, 2 years back, she decided to go back to her passion and write again.
That is really
fascinating. So as you can see, it's pretty, we have interesting family meetings.
Absolutely. And I add your parents to that as well. So you've got a brother in finance, a brother's a prosecutor, one in writing, a mother who's a teacher, and then a father who, I mean, a varied career, but amongst other things, a director in a higher education institution. So, that's an absolutely fascinating background. And I'd love to know some of your main interests outside of work as well.
So outside of work, I've have many interests, but I would say I've always had some important part of music in my life since I was a kid, and I continue to sing regularly in choirs, in very different settings. I've sung in operas, operettas, various concerts, and I continue to do so. So that's an important part of my life. Music definitely is an important part, and for the rest, it's a busy life anyways.
that's absolutely brilliant, the fact that music has you know remained a passion and you're still involved in it and participating in concerts, etc. Has that gone over into any of your three daughters?
No, unfortunately. One of those is extremely gifted for painting and I would say, generally for more manual arts. One of the three, actually the elder one, also plays the piano. And it's interesting because she are learning in a very different way. I used to be in the music school when I was a kid. She has never gone to any music school. And when she was maybe 14, 15, she decided to start learning the piano with YouTube.
Wow. Okay.
Pedagogical innovation, and it works better.
Exactly. Okay. All right. My just last question then on you before we come on to some of the topics in higher education is you spent a large part of your career in leadership roles in large industrial companies. The main focus of the conversation is obviously going to be on education. So I'd just love any key points from that phase of your life, from the industrial leadership side of your life that you'd like to highlight, and perhaps how they inform you as an executive today in education.
I think I would take away two or three learnings or two or three drivers. I've always been fascinated by engineering. I've been fascinated by how you actually design processes, you produce things, you create, you change. You change actually raw materials into something. Changing, transforming is definitely something I find extremely attractive in the three industrial groups I worked for. That's one. The second one is in the three companies, I've been always amazed by the focus on R&D and how you invest in inventing your own future, how you invest into developing the right solutions for your customers, for the impact you want to have, and how you dedicate lots of efforts with a strong, focus on time, return. And I'm very surprised to say that, and I was very surprised when I came to education to see that it was not that much the core of the focus of educational institutions, research and development. Ironically, and actually, it's also one of the drivers of Copernia. We can talk about it later. But this sort of absence of structure R&D, where people are really obsessed with changing, making a good usage of money, thinking of the time, better done than perfect. How do we go faster? How do we change? How do we move? How do we progress? And I liked it a lot. And the third is definitely I liked industry because, like in many businesses, I assume, there is a sort of human adventure. You have big projects that require lots of different expertise. You will need to be very holistic in the way you think of big things. And just to mention one thing, when I was at Nexon, something I found extremely fascinating was these subsea cables for interconnections. How do you create and install a cable that is 1,000 kilometers long to transfer the excess electricity from the UK to Norway, for instance? These are projects that spread over 10 years, that transform the world, that have a massive impact. But as you can imagine, it's super complex. It requires so many different skills, so many different, I would say competences. It's fascinating. And it's really an interesting journey. And I liked it a lot. Actually, these three kind of, I would say, areas definitely are things I learned a lot from. And I'm excited to bring that into this educational sector.
That's wonderful, Nicola. All three of them, the engineering, transforming, making things, the second R&D and innovation, and the third adventure and doing big things are all wonderful themes. The second one in particular is one that resonates for me. It's a bit of a quandary that I think we have in education, in that education, yep, like every other sector, requires innovation. However, innovation in education is hard because it's, you know, in K-12, it's people's children, in higher education, it's young adults, and people don't, there's a feeling of going with the tried and tested, yep, rather than something new or innovative. And yet we do need innovation in education. Yep. So it's a quandary that's there, but that said, there is a middle ground where you can go, where you can innovate responsibly and gradually taking steps forward.
I think it's an important topic. I'm not too familiar with the educational debate in Africa, but I'm super surprised, notably in France, to see that the debate is not grounded on research, on measured developments. It's very based on opinions. Lots of people have lots of opinions, but it's not very grounded. It's not very supported. It's not demonstrated. And it's a big thing, because I think at the end of the day, we would all benefit from having a more rational, grounded kind of debate. It's a very important topic. I think education matters to all of us. And strangely enough, the sector where you are supposed to have most researchers is at the same time the area where this is not really questioned, developed.
Yeah. So that's wonderful. I think the reason that everyone has an opinion is everyone has gone to school. So therefore, everyone, we all feel that we have an opinion, even if one doesn't know that much about it. So 100% identify with that as well. Look, I'd say, just on closing on the personal side, is thank you very much for sharing some of the formative parts of your journey and about your family and your upbringing, etc. And the one that most sat with me is your daughter's journey, and the fact that as we are having this conversation, she's writing her exams, you know, right now. So very fitting that we'd be having this conversation on this day. Let's move on then to some of the main topics for discussion in innovation in higher education. So let's just start right at the beginning. What is Copernia?
So it's a good question. I would start from a consideration. I was very questioned by some reports of the World Economic Forum. The starting point is, actually, when you look at the various surveys they've made over the past years, they concur in saying there is a massive change in competences in the world. And what the latest figures show, 60% of the jobs are supposed to change drastically their core competences within the 5 years to come. So massive challenges in all possible sectors of our societies and economies. At the same time, when you ask schools, colleges, universities, training centers, 90% of them are sure that their job will be fundamentally impacted within the 5 years to come. Notably, but not only, because of AI. So in other words, a massive change in competence, and the people most directly in charge of accompanying this transfer preparatory work for new competences recognize themselves as very much at a crossroad and don't necessarily know how to tackle it. They have lots of questions, a lot of uncertainties. So my translation of this is, we have a fundamental challenge of educational transformation that starts with educational institutions, and not only against schools and universities, but it goes beyond, including training centers, corporate learning and development. So the idea is, how do we, and when you look actually at the various offers, notably, just to take an anecdote, Masters of Education in Europe, you have 516 Masters of Education in Europe. None of them is actually focused on educational transformation with a holistic view. You do have some specialized in educational policies. You do have some specialized in online learning. You do have, so in other words, it's scattered, very fragmented. And my starting point was, maybe we should think of it in a more holistic way, because transforming education requires a different set. It's about policies, it's about online learning, it's about tech, it's about cognitive impacts, it's about lots of things. And how could we build something like this? So that has been something in my head for some time, and actually probably even before I joined Galileo. Then I had to learn the job because I had no experience in education. And for 4 years, as CEO positions in Galileo, I've learned a lot. And it has been a sort of trainee program for me for 4 years. And after 4 years, I decided to shift. And I picked up a number of universities within Galileo with some people that were really, convinced of the same thing, that we have an opportunity to try and build something, a sort of transformation, education transformation school. And that was the starting point of Copernia 1.5 years ago. And why did we call it Copernia, this initiative? To say, okay, what can we do? What kind of programs could we do to try and prepare better or contribute better to the preparation for this change? Copernia, it will be no surprise to you, it echoes, of course, Galileo. Copernic and Galileo, with 1 century of time difference between both of them, are the guys that actually helped change the perspective on the world for the Western world. Suddenly, making it very clear that no, the center is not on Earth, the center is in the sun. and it changes everything. And I would say I have the same thread. I think if we want to transform education, there is a fundamental conviction. The center is not the institution. The center is the individual. That's a Copernican revolution. Let me take a very simple example. If you look currently at the way examinations are structured in higher education, you would find more or less all over the world bachelor's, master's degree, doctorate, whatever you name it. But fundamentally, you would say, okay, it's 3-4 years, then 2, then, I don't know, 5 or 7. Mm-hmm. But the reality is it's very based on the institutional practical aspects. What would an individual be prevent him from doing the bachelor in 1.5 years or 5 years? Why do we have 3 years? Because it's convenient for the institution. And my point is, okay, but where is, at the end of the day, do we really put the interest of the individual learner first? And I question it. And I think it can actually have many impacts on the way you look at different educational topics. Okay. If you really start thinking, let's take the individual first. Of course, there are constraints. Of course, there remains a need for check-in, for ensuring, for quality proof, whatever you name it. But the question would be, are we sure we really maximize the interest of every individual learner on his journey? And I think that's a key question. And actually, I believe it's one of the main differences between various systems, various, I would say, success factors in education. Are you really have this starting point? Not to say that it does not exist. Of course, I would say all instructors on earth are very, very concerned about the individual development of everyone. But how far does it go? And obviously this, I believe this is at a tipping point, because personalizing the courses for 30 kids at school was probably very tough 5 years ago. Now, having a more personalized touch for every single kid in a school becomes probably more accessible, because we understand their brain work better, because we can design solutions. AI obviously plays a big role. So I believe fundamentally we are at this tipping point where things that were very tough become more accessible. And the question is, how do we seize this opportunity? Not that easy, again, because it's regulated, because, of course, institutions continue to have their own constraints because the business model is tough. But again, it's a challenge. And very often I just try to think, okay, let's try and imagine how people in 20 years from now will look at our current day situation. And probably many of them will tell us, well, you know, it's weird. We had the same course for 30 kids. How come? It sounds very weird to us now.
Yeah, so that's a driver. That's wonderful, Nicola. I think there's, you know, for me, two main insights there that just touch on everything else that you would do in this institution. The first being the need for transforming education itself, and an institution and courses which are focused on education itself. It, I think of it as though, you know, the dentist needs some work on his or her own teeth, or the doctor or the cobbler with the shoes, you know, and that's exactly what this is an instance of. And the second is this point of putting the learner at the center. And it sounds like a fairly simple, straightforward point. But if you really go through and implement that, that will touch everything on that institution.
Yeah, absolutely.
Starting with, you said, like, you know, moving away from this credit system that you have to be here for 4 years in order to do a degree. I didn't tell my parents this, but I did feel, you know, even in our university time, we used to have like 2 month holidays, you know, and I'd say we're probably in actual university for probably about 7 months of the year would be my estimate, maybe 8 months of the year, and different students themselves work at different paces. So, I think it's I absolutely hear you that point on as people get credentials, they move forward rather than everyone being synchronous.
To complete on Copernia. So what is Copernia? So it's four universities within Galileo that designed the first Masters of Innovation and Tech for Education. That was the starting point. And how does it work? It brings, obviously, the four institutions bring their own expertise into various, I would say, building blocks I referred to, educational sciences, pedagogy, cognitive neurosciences, tech, AI, data analytics, innovation design, management leadership. So I would say the core ingredients of transformation. And the beauty, of course, why was it born within Galileo rather than outside or rather than somewhere else? It's because Galileo is a unique experimentation field. And it helps us overcome some of the institutional difficulties we may face, because not all regulatory bodies all over the years have the same constraints or the same apprehension of change. So we have, I would say, unique flexibility to test things in very various settings, test it, demonstrate it, come back to others. And I think that's really what we try to do. Copernia is always this initiative that brings an experimentation with a structure path forward to try and propose such programs.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Thank you, Nicola. Maybe let's take that forward then. So can you, putting the learner at the center now in this question, so how would my experience differ as a student at Copernia in this first master's program versus, let's just pick any generic traditional university experience?
Well, first of all, we don't expect to have huge classes and cohorts. So again, it varies from country to countries, but let's say we will probably have more focused classes. And then, of course, in the design of the program, it's structured in four semesters for the traditional MSc, because for now, we have not yet overcome this 2 years definition. So we have this structure for now. And the idea is really to learn and test innovation on your own ideas and projects. So you will start as a student to have your foundational knowledge on all these ingredients that I mentioned. You will actually articulate that with the first research project for education management. That's the way we structured it, to be confronted with the constraints of the system and the business model of educational institutions. But you can pick up whatever kind of, if you come from South Africa, you probably will not have the same approach than someone coming from China or elsewhere. And that's great like this. The second one is to really be focused on an applied project for one school or different kind of schools. And here again, you will have your individual ideation development path. And the idea is, third, you will specialize. You will be able to dedicate your third semester to two specializations. One is sectorial. Are you more interested in topics for K-12, for higher ed, for continuing education? That's one. And the second one is, are you willing to go deeper into the cognitive aspects of this, I would say, debates, into the tech aspects, into the pedagogical aspects or the managerial aspects? So it's pretty tailor-made already. And last one, of course, the research thesis and the internship, which is a fourth semester, is really around testing your ideation on real settings and measuring its impact. So that's the first layer. I would say you build your own curriculum, because at the end of the day, it's about your own ideation or the own projects you develop all over your journey. That's number one. The second one is, we believe, and of course we learn a lot, and it's, I would not say, okay, it's all ready and it works flawlessly, but we have designed the production process with a lot of AI inside to actually generate, adapt, personalize the content of courses. including in terms of design and also in terms of utilizing it in the LMS. And as you know, while the LMS are becoming more and more adaptable, we work with Blackboard in this very case. We are one of the largest customers of Blackboard, I would assume. And we have worked very closely with them on their roadmap, development roadmap, to really privilege and prioritize what makes the LMS delivery most personalized. So that's the second part of the journey, which is really how do we leverage AI to make it as personalized as possible. Obviously, the idea is AI also helps us upgrade the content faster and adapt it to your needs. Just for your info, we have been testing now for some time a pedagogical bot in some of our schools, which also evolves very much over time as personal support from our students. So it's both a question of the content, the journey, and the objective. And that's, I would say, what sets probably the project of Copernia a little aside from traditional models, at least at the ambition.
That's really exciting, and lots of personalization, specialization, and also experimentation using Galileo's global network.
If I had to sum up the program in one sentence, it's really learn, experiment, and measure the impact of your own innovation, intuitions, and projects, and test it on real settings. I think what differs is actually we are blessed because I don't think there are so many comparable institutions within Galileo. The objective is not, of course, to be only within Galileo, but already within Galileo, you can test in many different settings, from cookie makings in Bordeaux to medical studies in Costa Rica and fashion design in Riyadh. So it's relatively easy to go and check, test different things, different settings, different disciplines, and test it for real. All the more that, of course, we worked with lots of ecosystems, with different business, academic, tech partners. So it's really the idea of being embedded into a real environment that actually favors your structured development, again, from ideation to measuring your own impact.
That's brilliant. And I actually just want to go ahead and follow you there. Copernia is being started within Galileo. There's four Galileo institutions which have teamed up for this. And you prior were COO of the broader Galileo group. So perhaps let's just go there. Can you tell us a bit more about the broader Galileo group and its background?
Galileo is a very interesting animal and probably pretty unique. It's probably not the largest higher education institution. I know you know most of them now following your podcasts. We actually know that there are larger institutions in Brazil, in China, India, possibly. So we don't compete on numbers. 320 is a lot. By the way, we used to be 65,000 students when I joined 5 years ago.
Wow.
So still.
5x growth.
5.5 years ago, and we multiply the number of students by 5.5. So I don't know whether the dynamic will go on like this forever. When I listen to our CEO, it means that his ambition is to create one of the widest human communities with 1 million students down the road. I don't know how much it will take. But of course, the interesting part of it is that it's super diverse. It's spread over many countries, and that is not that frequent. The core, obviously, is in France and in Europe, which still represents a lot of the activity. But currently, we are also present in China, India, Dubai. We will open our first school in Riyadh in 2 months. We are present in Senegal, Ivory Coast, Brazil, with a recent acquisition of 65,000 students. We have a strong presence in Mexico, Costa Rica, Guatemala. We have, and that's for outside of Europe and within Europe. Of course, obviously, France plays a big role because currently we probably have around 1,020 students, which is big. But as you can understand, it's 40% maybe of the total number of students. Online, on-site, very much on the ground sometimes, because we are in higher education. But in some cases, higher education is not only with diplomas that are sophisticated, academically related. We have lots of professional trainings, more and more, by the way, including for truck drivers, for forklift drivers, industrial jobs, in the northern part of France. So France is a very interesting thing because I think we have something like 25 different schools. We have one leading business school with EM Lyon. We have one. We have the largest online university of France, which is called Studi. We have this professional center in the northern part of France. So France is a pretty unique lab already. But beyond that, we are present in the UK with a comprehensive university in London, but also with a dance and music academy in Liverpool. We are present in the Nordics. We have a tech university. You mentioned it. Norrof is part of Copernia. But we also have professional centers in Sweden. We have three schools in Germany, I think with 8 or 9 campuses in total.
Nicolas, I'm getting dizzy. I'm getting dizzy here. So many institutions.
So many institutions growing fast. And obviously, it's an interesting animal for that because many disciplines, many different deliveries, many different environments, many different regulatory environments. A huge and unique opportunity to experiment, test, and share. That's the message.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. And I'm actually curious on this because I think these groups of this sort of scale, you know, over 300,000 students, 20 countries, many of which you've named, I think you gave that scale very, very clearly. I think traditionally a lot of us would have gone to, you know, one-off universities. So for instance, I went to the University of Cape Town for my undergrad. I went to Stanford for my postgrad. You know, there's no other sort of University of Cape Town somewhere else in the world or a Stanford. What do you think are some of the benefits to studying at an institution that's part of a wider group versus a single standalone institution?
Well, I would say just let's take one step back. In reality, Galileo is a very decentralized group. And actually, I suspect that most of our schools have a much larger brand awareness than Galileo per se. If you interview even students, teachers, or whomever in the countries, all of them will know the name of your school. Few of them will know the name of Galileo.
Understood. So Galileo is the corporate brand, maybe known by investors, but the underlying schools, M. Lyon, Norrof, that's what students and parents
they keep
know.
Their DNA, and it's a very important feature of the model. It's really, I would say, it's not your sort of homogenizing system where you would have a sort of retail chain of schools and you would find the same school all over the world. Mm. In some cases, some of our schools do have their own campuses all over the world. That's the case for Mahogany, is a very leading fashion school, and they have now their campuses in China, India, Dubai, and others. But again, that's their DNA, and they have a sort of consistent experience across the board. But we will never force any school to look like Mahogany. So that's a very important thing. So we have an HQ, which actually has a sort of, as you highlighted, it's recognized by investors. It is lean. The center of Galileo is very lean. It's really a sort of, I would say, the idea is really serve and control. In other words, it's a small group that is really here to serve and support the development of the schools, which are led by school directors, which are really accountable for their development and their performance. So that's the core thing. But they have to abide by a number of core principles in HR, in finance, in sales and marketing, in student experience. So you're sort of core principles that need to be applied. And then the school will develop their own story. Of course, being part of such a large thing, it would be absurd not to have any synergies between any of the schools. So many of our schools start having cross experiences, dual diplomas, specific journeys. Copernia is a good example. Actually, it's not just a sort of dual diploma. It's a joint degree. It was designed together with 4 institutions. It will be executed by 4 in different institutions. But again, we have not forced anyone. And the idea is if you have to deliver the value of your synergy. So to make a long story short, I would say for the students, it's interesting because it opens up over time more and more opportunities to develop a sort of interesting journeys across schools. But it's not mandatory. It's not systemic. It's more and more because we see more and more the value of working together with 2 or 3 very different schools that want to have something in common. Typically, if you say Regent's University in the UK works closely with Mahogany, which is more in fashion, with Macromedia, which is more in design. And that's great. And they have good opportunities, not only to have dual diplomas, but in this very case, to design specific offers. So So part of the story of Galileo is designing interesting offers that are pretty unique, that you would not probably find in other universities. But again, the very story is, it's a confederation of entrepreneurs that are willing to develop some interesting synergies rather than being told to do so, if it makes
Understood.
Sense.
Understood. No, that makes a lot of sense. And just at the student level, so taking Copernia as an example, we spoke up front, it's a partnership between, you know, university in Germany, France, Cyprus, and Norway. Mm-hmm. At the student level, for instance, can my home campus be, you know, M Lyon in France, but I can spend time at Macromedia University in Germany? Is that possible as part of the program at Copernia and broader within Galileo?
So the way it's designed, so again, the first intake will take place in the next month. So the way it's designed is the first year of the program will take place in Paris in a very interesting setting because it's a brand new campus, brand new not because the building is very old. We actually took over a building that was built 140 years ago to host the National Institute of Agronomy in the very core of Paris. And if you're familiar with Paris, it's really, I would say, 500 meters away from the Panthéon, La Sorbonne, many other universities. It's unique. It's Le Quartier Latin, so Latin Barrel, whatever you name it. So that's in the middle of it. It's an old building, but we took over the lease some years back. We took 3 years to refurbish everything and to make it to the best possible standards. Within this campus, you will have different schools. Very different schools. We will have Paris School of Business, a business school. We will have Atelier de Sèvres, which is one of the best art schools in France. We will have Penningen, which is one of the leading institutions for architectural design and arts direction. We will have Cour Florent Executives, the leading school for drama play. We'll have the Web School Factory being part of it, and we will have IESA Arts and Culture, which is a school for managing the arts professions. Imagine all this in the same building. And Copernia, the little one, will be nested within this environment. Moreover, within, I would say, one walking distance, 10-minute distance, you would find 4 or 6 other different schools of Galileo. So the idea is obviously to offer our students an immediate experience of what it means to have hybrid experiences with different, very different schools. So that's a project we have for this campus in general and for Copernia in particular. Now, beyond that, the idea I told you is very much centered around projects in real settings. So we will obviously propose students to work with dedicated schools, which could be part of this campus or beyond. So that will be a direct exposure. On top of that, when you come to semester 3, depending on the specialization you will follow, you will actually spend your semester either in Cyprus or in Germany. And regarding the last part, which is the internship, obviously the idea is to offer internships within the group or beyond the group, where the students can choose where they want to see their impact. So, in a nutshell, yes, there are lots of flexibility around the location and the experience you can draw. And again, the fact to be within Galileo makes a difference because intuitively you understand that, yes, it's much easier within the family to try and grab the right opportunities for both the students and the schools that will host and support them.
That's brilliant, Nicola. And something that really stands out for me there with your description of the building in Paris and all those different schools within it is one of the things that has been a challenge historically is if you go to some of the more niche colleges, let's just take fashion as an example. So my sister-in-law, mm-hmm. for instance, went to a fashion college, quite a niche institution and quite small. So you don't get the broader campus experience, which someone who goes to, you know, a big public university or something like that would get with a lot of other people of a similar age, yeah. and you're all there together. It's not only what you learn in the classroom that obviously matters, as you know.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful here that you are being able to, people are still getting that core niche experience, but they're also getting the broader campus feel and meeting students from a lot of different backgrounds and a lot of other people.
I think that's a blessing for us because, as you understand, Copernia is a sort of startup within this group. And imagine a startup being nested within already a mix of 6 different schools. It's a blessing.
Mm. Absolutely, absolutely. So if I say then just on Galileo, and this is the Education Investment Podcast, as you know, so I've got a couple of investment-related questions. So Galileo is backed by some really excellent institutional mm-hmm. investors, Canada Pension Plan, Montague Private Equity, and a few others. So in your view, what is the appeal of, or how do you articulate the investment case of private higher education?
I think there are a couple of interesting drivers that can explain why investors decide to go for us and for other large institutions in education. I think the fundamental, it's like Warren Buffett. If I understand in 5 minutes, probably it's worth having a look. Everybody understands that the need to learn will increase drastically over the decades. Because the world is changing, you need to develop new competences, and more, you will need to develop competences all along your life. So the first fundamental thing is actually, yes, there will be a growing need for training and education, and it will never stop. So that's a first interesting entry point, I would say. I remember some years back, the Prime Minister of Singapore mentioning that around 2030-35, we would probably spend 120 days a year learning. Let's meet in 10 years from now. I'm sure he's right. Sure. So that's the first point, number one. The second one is, of course, we may have different sounds and the situation is not exactly alike all over the place for higher education. And you know the demographic pressures we see in Europe, in America, and actually in many countries. But at the end of the day, higher education grows very fast on a global scale. Again, the World Economic Forum mentions that higher education, there will be 20% more higher education professionals in 5 years from now. Why? Because it continues to grow massively in India, in Africa, in some specific environments for higher education alone. Let's put aside the growing part of continuing education. But even in higher education, it will continue to grow. So that's the second interesting look at it. The third one is actually education is a tough business. It's tough for everyone. It's tough for private and public because it requires dedication, investment, innovation, technology, professionals, teachers. It's a big business, but it's a complex business. And it requires to be very agile, and more it will be so. So this is a challenge for the public sector in general, and we see, and it goes back to my previous comment, the difficulty is you have to accelerate the pace of innovation, but at the same time, you're pretty conservative because of regulatory purpose, or you are regulated because of whatever, but at least you have this constraint. And public sector, actually depending on the countries, but you see overall a trend for more and more private players. That's also part of the story. So more education globally, more education, higher education, more continuing education, and a growing share of private, because the public sector has difficulties to cope with the rhythm of change. So I think that's probably the sort of mega trends I would highlight. The another one is actually the sector is extremely fragmented. Yeah. I believe we are one of the largest, but we are super tiny if you look at the world. And again, even with 1 million students, you would still be very tiny across the globe. There are many more learners. So it's super fragmented, which probably offers opportunities for some sort of consolidation. Not all of those consolidation look like ours, and there are other networks that develop more standardized approaches. I think there are many different models, but for sure, the fragmentation is a call to action because in a number of cases, you still have to invest and amortize your investment in a decent way. I mentioned the fact that we are decentralized, but there are some areas where we centralize the effort. We are currently designing our own student information system. It's costly. It requires a big effort. And if you're in an independent school, you cannot afford it. So yes, there is a value in having some critical mass and structuring this. So going away from too much fragmentation to, I would say, thoughtful consolidation makes a lot of sense. Last but not least, I think for investors, the sector is at a crossroad because precisely you have lots of investments, lots of changes. And at the same time, you have a growing feeling, and I think it's more and more massive. that you will survive as a group in education if you can provide your students with a strong ROI on their studies.
Mm.
And that's also a core to really make sure that we get there, which is not very easy. It's interesting to see that it works both ways. Look at the US, the number of students is decreasing. Not because there is less need for education, but because the cost of education becomes irrelevant versus the value it delivers.
Mm.
So we are at a crossroad in the way, how do you develop a model that is sustainable, attractive for the students, sustainable for the institution and the shareholders? It's tough. So here again, I suspect that the thesis from investors is there is a premium for those that are managed at the best level because they will win. Not easy. You have to pick up very selectively, but yes, there is a value in being better than others in this sector, a big value. So megatrends and probably this crossroad that actually will differentiate the performance within the sector.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant, Nicola. And the growth of private higher education is a theme that I'm excited about and have invested behind. Dynamics in some of the markets I've invested in a bit different from say, France and Europe. The gross enrollment ratios are a lot lower here in Africa, as I think you know. So there's still just a simple big access gap, you know, before you even get to some of the topics of quality, et cetera. And I think that's going to be a multi-decade runway still to play out. And in truth, that's a bit of a travesty that so many of our, you know, African, call it young adults between the ages of 18 and say 24 just don't get the opportunity to study in a university or a college.
I think it's, for me, that the fundamental, I don't know whether to translate it appropriately, the mother of all battles. More equity in the world requires massive investment to bridge the gap of accessibility. Massive. And bridging the gap of accessibility is not just a question of putting more subsidies, is to design the models that are indeed by design more accessible. It's super tough.
Yes.
It's super tough. And it requires lots of intelligence, commitment, I would say savvy financial decisions. So it's a big, 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 big battle. I'm sure we will not get bored anytime soon.
absolutely. I certainly won't. And I'm intrigued because you mentioned a lot of your business is still France and Europe, and you've got a lot outside of that. But let's just take that market. So, in many of those countries, public universities will be free. But the students are still voting with their feet. They're coming to your institutions where they do pay. So what's driving that?
I think if I want to make it very blunt, it's a mix of two things. It's it may be expressed as such, maybe not, but I think fundamentally the idea is the ROI for students. It is costly to make studies. It's costly because of the tuition fees, it's costly because of accommodation, actually accommodation probably more than fees. And even the public sector, which is for free, very often is not for free because you have to relocate. So every kind of study has a cost. The cost of not working, the cost of relocating, the cost of paying for your studies. But at the end of the day, the question is, do I prefer to pay, I don't know, for a bachelor, 30k euro, to take the example in France, 30k euros to have 85% insertion on the job market when I'm done for decent jobs at 30-35k per year? Or do I prefer to go to university where probably I will spend not 3 but 4 years because it takes more time, it's less, I would say, demanding, less pressure. And at the end of the day, well, I will have invested my 4 years, but not too sure that the insertion will be as high. Of course, it depends on disciplines or jobs, whatever, but I believe that's a fundamental point. We see that, for instance, I mentioned France is a very good case, but let's take Norof. Norof is in Norway. In Norway, everything is for free. Still, you have, it's 80% vocational, 20% academic. Still, we do not suffer too much from finding people that are willing to go and have their certificates and programs because Norof is the best in cybersecurity and techno. So going there, they are sure to increase their salaries when they go out. They are looked after by recruitment agencies and companies because what they deliver at Norof is actually unique and much better than anything else they could find for free in other institutions. So this driver is probably number one. The second thing is, and here again, I would not make general comments because I'm not familiar enough with all the world, but the student experience is critical. how do I develop my soft skills? How do I grow within the institution? Some people might feel very comfortable being in a large academic environment with big amphitheaters and no real personalized follow-up, and it's fine for them. But many kids, many young adults, actually prefer to be very, very much in a professionalizing path with a strong connection to the business world from day one. They appreciate being in smaller groups. They possibly appreciate being under tougher pressure. So student experience is definitely another driver for choice. And I think the combination of both probably explains these dynamics that remain very strong even in countries where most of the studies are public and for free.
Okay, no, that's really informative and insightful. Thanks, Nicola. Another topic that I'm keen to understand is your approach to real estate. So do you prefer to operate in an asset-heavy manner, so owning your real estate, or in a more asset-light manner, leasing your properties?
Here again, we are very pragmatic and we are analytic. I would say, let's take two different cases. But overall, the answer is we do not have a policy to own our buildings in general. Why? Because again, we are in an environment where the school directors are entrepreneurs. They have to grow to be agile and to adapt all the time. And in a way that contradicts the idea of being, okay, let's put ourselves in a box and it will not move. Again, when you look at the growth of the group, a big part of it comes from acquisition, but the reality is a very big part of it comes from organic growth. Mm. It's amazing to see how much organic growth there is in the group. And it reflects the fact that indeed the school directors develop, create new schools, and go to new campuses. They change 3, 4, 5 times within 20 years because the number of students rise and so on. So that's the first one. The value is in having this flexibility to move fast. As you can imagine, it's also an indirect synergy for the group. Let's take Paris. I believe we have 35 buildings for schools. So depending on the growth of the one and the other, you have a sort of mercato of the schools to play, and that accompanies and optimizes in a way the cost of real estate. So that's, I would say, the overall principle. Now, having said that, in certain cases, the real estate can become part of the core assets of a school. It's especially true for the more exclusive kind of schools. Because obviously there is a sort of identification of the schools to the building where it is. Let's take Marangoni. Marangoni will relocate in September in a unique building very close to the Duomo in Milan. Can you imagine that it's a leading fashion and art school, and they will be hosted in a former convent with paintings from Frangelico?
Wow.
It really is a part of their DNA. It really puts them aside. It really differentiates them from the rest of the world. And in this case, yes, the assumption is it brings value to their business. If I take Le Delta, which is the name of the Galileo campus in Paris, we don't own it. We have a long-term lease. The question could arise at some point. If I take EM Lyon Business School in Lyon, they actually own their building and they built a brand new building over the past four or five years, because it was also important for them. It's one of the leading schools in France, leading business schools. So they decided to take this decision to be on their own on a brand new thing that has been designed by themselves. So in this case, why not? It makes sense. So as you can see, the criterion is, does it really deliver value for your brand? Yes or no? What is the real value of your brand? If I'm called ESG, ESG is a sort of, I would say, management school that we have in France, not the super high level, but super professionalizing, super insertion rate for people that were not spectacular in their academic results. Their value is not in the building. Their value is in how well they are accompanied to enter the job market. In some other case, entering the job market is an obsession for all of our schools, but in certain cases, it's true that you have other considerations. Let's take another example in Africa, precisely. We just opened some months back a brand new campus on our own in Dakar. Here again, the statement was, at some point, having a brand new building on our own, which is really top modern, a leading campus for Senegal, brings value to our school over there. So it's a case-by-case analysis, practical and at the same time always driven by the value. Does it bring value to the brand? Yes or no? If yes, let's think of it. If no, let's be flexible because that's where the value is.
Understood. That's a very nuanced answer. Thank you very much, Nicola.
You're welcome.
Just then, on my last question on higher education before I come back to you right at the end, it's just how you think about the social impact of the work that you do in higher education. This applies both to your work in Capernaum and more broadly across your work in Galileo.
I think let's have one step at Galileo's mission statement. It's a mission statement actually I helped design with many of the schools when I was CEO of the group. And the statement we came to is really enable everyone, regardless of their starting point, to unleash their potential and boost their long-term employability. That's the core message. To make a long story short, I believe there is more social value in accompanying any student, wherever he or she comes from, than selecting the best and making them even better. In other words, if you pick up someone that is already super bright, okay, you can still bring some value, but that's not the toughest education job. The job that brings most value is, okay, come as you are. It was, I remember, a slogan of McDonald's at some point. We don't care how you are, but our mission is come as you are, and we will together bring up your potential, bring up your employability. That's the value, and I think that's the social mission of education in general, higher education in particular. That's what we look after. And I think that's what drives me, that's what wakes me up in the morning. So how can we bring that value? How can we help everyone go one step further, one step brighter, further, faster, and unleash the potential everyone has? And it's a lot around accessibility. It's a lot around personalization. It's a lot about inclusion. And I think that's what I'm really very focused on. And despite, of course, there are contradictory tensions, as you can imagine, in a private equity group, you have also a constant pressure on results. And I think the art and beauty, if I may, is to really continue to work in that direction. You know, as I say, I don't know who said that, keep your look at the star and keep your feet on the ground. If you do select one of the two, you're lost. Being too much in the stars, you will go nowhere. Being too much in the ground, you will lose your direction. And in a way, maybe over-optimistic, but being in a PE has a benefit of reminding you every day that you have your feet on the ground.
Absolutely. But at the same time... That's wonderfully said, Nicola.
So yeah, that's a little bit what I'm convinced of.
That's wonderfully said, Nicola. Internally, our phrase that we use for a similar thing with some of my colleagues is you have to look up and look down at the same time. And it says exactly that same point. Got to be focused on the here and now and making sure you execute every day very well, but at the same time, knowing where you're going and making sure you're headed in the right direction.
That's a daily challenge.
absolutely. Okay. I've really learned a lot, both about Capernaum, about Galileo, and more broadly about private higher education institutions in the conversation. So thank you for that. I'll come back around then now to you as I ask my concluding guest and my concluding question. And I ask the same concluding question to all of our guests. And that is, please tell us about your favorite teacher or lecturer or educator.
Actually, it's a tough question because I have had many different teachers that I really liked a lot and that impressed me. So I have had the time to think about your question. So I have an answer. I would like to pay a special tribute to one of my teachers. Her name was Mrs. Perret-Gentil, and she was a math teacher. When I prepared, you know, the competitive exams we have for the business schools in France. So we call it class préparatoire, preparatory classes, and you prepare for a competitive exam after 1 or 2 years. And obviously, when we prepared that, all year long, we had 4 hours sort of mock examinations to get prepared for that. And I liked very much the way she structured it, because you had your 4 hours, and she said, you know, if you're stuck with your problem, raise your hands, ask your neighbor or ask me for help. It's much better that you use your time to progress and learn together rather than to fail alone. And for me, that's the real practical definition of student-centered pedagogy. What matters is what you will do better, and to do better, probably, if you need help, let's make sure you have this help. And in a way, I don't know whether it was inspirational or not, but it's very much the way I look at Copernia. Take the experience of others to progress rather than stay alone. And that's, I believe, a very good definition of the value of schools. So thanks a lot, Mrs. Perret-Gentil. I have no contacts anymore for many years. Now, because I thought of this question, I will try to find her back.
And send her the clip, please. No, that's absolutely a wonderful tribute to her and the message that she landed and the impact she had on your life. So, Nicola, I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. And thank you for taking the time this morning and for teaching us about your own journey, your own path through industrial leadership into higher education and the deep dive that we then had in private higher education here today. I wish you all of the best in Copernia. It's a wonderful initiative. And as we said, the dentist needs some help on the teeth in this instance. And Copernia is providing exactly that. So we'll be supporting your journey and your development and looking forward to seeing the organization grow.
Thank you so much, Mandé. I think it's been a very, very pleasant and very interesting talk. I'm again super honored that you invited me, and I hope that well, we are not the only two that enjoyed it. and let's keep in touch. I'm really eagerly looking forward to exchanging more together.